So as usual, our disclaimer, this is not medical advice, and when you talk to people about brain chemistry, it's especially important that you tell them that you're just educating them, because weaning people off of medications for brain chemistry stuff, depression, anxiety, et cetera, is not only a bad idea because it's not legal within your scope of practice, but it could be dangerous. It's things that you have to move really carefully with. So when they learn stuff, a lot of people want to jump in and say, oh, I'm just going to get off my meds and do this. And they really do need to be careful, wean off of meds slowly, and make sure that they're working with a doctor that can help them to wean off. So really be careful in this area, because it's an area where people, they hate being on psychiatric meds because of the side effects and the way that resistance happens, develops over time, and they have to change them and up the doses, and it can be really a nightmare. And if they feel like you've got some answers for them that to help them to correct underlying dysfunction and disturbances, then they oftentimes want to jump on it rather quickly. Sometimes that works, and other times it can backfire. So be careful with that.
What can we do to bring people back to balance? So I want you to be aware that there's a lot of things that affect the postsynaptic neurotransmission. We talked about those receptors can become resistant, but there's also things that affect those receptors. So, for example, for serotonin to be picked up by the postsynaptic neuron, it requires adequate amounts of estrogen. In males, it requires adequate amounts of testosterone. For dopamine to be picked up, you need adequate levels of progesterone. For dopamine, you also need adequate amounts of thyroid hormone. So if you've got hormone imbalance, you're working with somebody with hormone imbalance, and say you do this great workup and you really feel strongly about what you're giving them and you're helping them to produce more of these neurotransmitters, but they're not really getting the results, it could be that you have to look in these other places, that they don't have enough estrogen for that postsynaptic neuron to pick up the serotonin. And then blood sugar is super, super important for lots of reasons. Inflammation is one of them, the insulin-causing inflammation. The blood sugar swings, the resistance, the high sugars can affect the neurotransmission, but also you have to have enough sugar. So if you've got insulin resistance and you're not getting enough sugar into the cells, then you're going to affect the transmission. Inflammation and autoimmune disease have an effect on that transmission and can affect the ability of those receptors to pick up the neurotransmitter. Let's look at amino acids are critical for proper neurotransmitter function because they tend to be either the precursor or the neurotransmitter themselves. So tryptophan we talked about is related to serotonin and melatonin. Methionine is a precursor, kind of long around, roundabout way to glutathione. Phenylalanine is a precursor to tyrosine and dopamine and norepinephrine. Theanine is a precursor for glycine. Valine produces energy. Valine, isoleucine, and leucine are your branch chain amino acids, so they're not affected directly affecting neurotransmitters, but they are affecting it indirectly by being available to produce energy if need be. And then glycine is a precursor to glutamine. So if you have somebody that's got an arginine excess and a lysine deficiency, say they're eating a lot of chocolate and a lot of almonds and things like that, and they have a tendency towards herpes outbreaks, that can affect their ability to make glutamine. So that's going to affect not only the enterocytes in their gut from being healed, but also that can affect the uptake and the conversion of memories from short-term into long-term into storage. And the effect, it could also affect GABA by not having enough precursor to B or having too much. I'm going to summarize the specific nutrients for the specific neurotransmitters, and then towards the end we'll just give you some more of the general diet lifestyle things that help to support neurotransmission. So for serotonin, 5-HTP, vitamin B6, some of the other nutrients that are involved in there, like the folate and iron, are important. And then making sure that their person is taking tyrosine. If the person does not respond as you think they should when you put them on 5-HTP, serotonin precursors, then it could very well be related to the fact that those postsynaptic neurons are not accepting the serotonin. It could be a low estrogen situation in a male or a low testosterone situation in a female.
Some of the other factors that decrease serotonin activity would be, of course, protein deficiency, because you don't have enough of the precursors, the amino acids that you need to make the serotonin. And then things that interfere with either the uptake of or the ability of the postsynaptic neurons to function, heavy metals, pesticides, certain medications, caffeine, alcohol, nicotine, even something as innocuous seemingly as NutraSweet, people that are on those diet sodas, they don't realize how much that can be affecting their neurotransmitters. Some antidepressants deplete serotonin activity, including the SSRIs, which provide a temporary relief, but then oftentimes person ends up having to get on higher and higher doses because they're depleting their serotonin activity even further. Certain cholesterol-lowering medications affect serotonin activity, as well as if you put somebody on support for dopamine pathways. So you figure that they may have a dopamine deficiency and they're on certain things or certain nutrients, or they're self-medicating for the dopamine pathways, so say they're on Ritalin or marijuana, and there's more support of the dopamine pathways that actually can deplete the serotonin activity. So there's lots of things that can decrease serotonin activity, and these are kinds of things you need to be asking people when you do your history.
Let's look at dopamine, D-L-phenylalanine, that's DLPA, versus phenylalanine. Well, phenylalanine can either be in the L form or the D form. If you're supplementing with DL-phenylalanine, it's a combination of both. So the L form will convert to L-DOPA. The D form will convert to PEA, phenylethanolamine, which is a very nice calming, and then that can produce dopamine. So it's therapeutically, it's better to use the DLPA. If you just see something that says phenylalanine, you probably have to look at the back. You'll have to see which one it actually is, either D-phenylalanine or L-phenylalanine, but it has to be one or the other. Macuna pruriens, is an herb that actually contains L-DOPA, which can then convert to dopamine. So that can help people to manage their dopamine levels as well. And it's a really easy herb to incorporate. You can do a tincture or you can do powder. Put some powder in smoothies and in elixirs. Something called beta-phenylalanine and N-acetyltyrosine. That's an important one to talk about because a lot of times if we're trying to make more dopamine and we give tyrosine, that tyrosine can be converted into thyroid hormone. If you give it in just the plain tyrosine, and you may not get as much of it going down the pathway to dopamine as you think. So an N-acetyl form of tyrosine tends to convert better to dopamine. We talked about P5P as the cofactor. Selenium's another one. Blueberry extract is another really good precursor. Helps to make more dopamine, but also helps to make the receptors more receptive to it. Kind of like when we talked about insulin resistance, where there's certain nutrients that help the receptors to be less resistant and more receptive. And then N-acetylcysteine and glutathione. Glutathione is potent antioxidant, potent for protecting the membranes. And NAC is a really important precursor to glutathione. So let's look at some of the dopamine antagonists. Some of the things that can create dopamine deficiency would be deficiencies, obviously, of the cofactors we talked about, especially folate and iron. When the thyroid is underfunctioning, it antagonizes dopamine because it slows down transmission. Remember, thyroid affects metabolic rate and affects metabolic rate in all the tissues in the body. Anemia. Well, iron was one of the important cofactors. And anemia means there's less oxygen capacity, carrying capacity of the blood. And oxygen is super important for the effectiveness of those postsynaptic neurons and for the creation of neurotransmitters. Decreased stomach acid is going to cause you to absorb less of your amino acids. So really important to look at some of the basic stuff with digestion, especially when people are presenting with neurologic and neurotransmitter type problems, because you really need to look at the gut. You need to look at not only the stomach acid, but how well are they making enzymes? How good is their gut flora? Do they have damage? And then hormone imbalances. We already talked about the effect of progesterone and thyroid hormone on the receptors for dopamine. And then your liver is important for so much of this because that's where a lot of the detoxification happens. That's where a lot of the breakdown of some of these chemical constituents is going to occur. We talked about insulin to a large extent related to the blood sugar and insulin resistance. And if your cells are insulin resistant and you don't get enough sugar into the cells, you cannot make these neurotransmitters and the receptors don't work efficiently. We've already talked about oxygen deficiency and methylation issues. So dopamine is tied in. You remember the COMT, the catecholamine O-methyltransferase. Excess methyl groups can halt that pathway if there's an impairment there, but you need enough methyl groups in to be able to function. And so methylation problems, when you find people having the problems with one of those cycles or more than one of those cycles, then that can affect the dopamine production, especially the COMT. Let's talk about things that affect GABA. We've talked about these are the general things that affect all of our neurotransmitters. Stress especially affects GABA because stress affects cortisol production, and cortisol production can lead to issues with GABA. We talked about blood sugar, inflammation. I want to really focus on this issue with the GAD, the glutamic acid decarboxylase. We saw before that what gets converted, glutamic acid gets converted to GABA. And when you have a deficiency of that GAD enzyme, either because you've got antibodies to it, which is very common, or because you've got a genetic, a SNP, that doesn't allow that to process effectively, you get less production of GABA. So let's look at a couple of ways that you can test people. Well, let's look at the antagonist first. As pointed out earlier, that gluten affects all of our neurotransmitters. Toxic chemical exposure, pesticides, heavy metals, diabetes, and Hashimoto's all have an effect on GABA production. So let's look at some of the ways that you can see this. The picture on the right is the blood-brain barrier. And the blood-brain barrier, like the barrier in the gut, is there's a series of tight junctions. And it doesn't allow a lot to enter the brain. Obviously, we want those junctions to be quite tight so that heavy metals and pesticides and all kinds of toxins you're exposed to, metabolic byproducts, endotoxins from candida and other bacterial overgrowths, we don't want those things to get into the brain. So we have this tight junction in the blood-brain area. Unfortunately, that doesn't allow certain drugs and neurotransmitters to pass the blood-brain barrier either. So one of the ways that you can test to see if someone has an intact blood-brain barrier is to give them a 1,000-milligram dose of GABA. If they get improvement of their anxiety, overwhelm, worry, their GABA-type symptoms, what you're going to assume is that their blood-brain barrier is impaired. This is an important piece of information to know because these are the people that are going to be way more sensitive to the toxic effects of exposures. Being exposed to various perfumes, eating foods that are not organically grown and have pesticides on them, heavy metal exposure. These are the people who are going to react poorly if you try to put them on a detoxification program where they are pulling out the toxins and the heavy metals out of storage into circulation. Because if they're in circulation, then some of those are going to pass into the brain. So if you have people who get really bad neurologic symptoms or depressed or brain foggy, irritable, cranky, whenever they try to do any kind of cleansing regime or heavy metal removal regime, this could be why. I would be really careful in doing a challenged heavy metal urine test. If you recall what that is, it's when you have somebody take like a DMSA type of a substance or DMPS, and that pulls the heavy metals out of storage, and we measure it in the urine to see what their total body load is. Unfortunately, if you do that and this person has an impaired blood-brain barrier, then those metals are going to then get taken up by the brain tissue. Not a good thing to do. So it really reinforces the idea maybe before we do things like challenged heavy metal tests in people who have neurologic presentations, that we should be doing this GABA challenge, 1,000 milligrams of GABA, and see if that helps the situation or worsens the situation. another challenge, and this one is to test the activity of the GAD enzyme, the glutamic acid decarboxylase enzyme, is to get some alpha-ketoglutarate, which will get converted to glutamic acid. 3,000 to 4,000 milligram dose. So it's a pretty high dose. If they take that and they're impaired in that GAD enzyme, then they're not going to convert as much of that alpha-ketoglutarate downstream all the way to GABA. It's going to get stuck in the excitatory, and they may have some anxiety, irritability, a worsening of symptoms. And you can say it's likely a genetic or an autoimmune GAD deficiency. Okay? So these are some simple tests that you can have people do to get a sense of what's going on. And it's a lot less expensive than testing, like for GAD antibodies, is a very expensive test. Not to say not to do it in some cases, but a lot of times we're working with people and they just get overwhelmed by the amount of money it costs to test and the amount of money it costs to supplement. And if there are places where you can reduce that, it's better. So let's look at balancing GABA. So obviously you want to look at cofactors, right? So some of the cofactors in the various pathways of GABA processing are P5P, which is the active form of B6, magnesium, manganese, and zinc. Then there are certain substances that help to increase the receptor sensitivity for GABA. Valerian, for example. Valerian is used a lot in calming people down and trying to get people to fall asleep better at night. Lithium orotate. That's not the same as lithium sulfate that's used sometimes in bipolar and other serious depressive disorders. It's lithium orotate, which is actually an essential mineral. And the lithium orotate actually helps to increase the receptor sensitivity for GABA, as does passion flower. You know, passion flower, we talk about being really good for when the mind is go, 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 go. And when you take passion flower, it calms that down. And part of the way it does that is by increasing the receptor sensitivity to GABA. And then there are ways to get more GABA as providing precursors or molecules that are similar in structure and function similarly, which would be taurine and another amino acid, L-theanine. L-theanine is used a lot in, it's used a lot in kids with ADD to calm them down. And part of it is because it converts to GABA, but it has calming effects in and of itself. Let's look at acetylcholine. Balancing acetylcholine. There's a substance called L-huperzine A. It comes from a plant called club moss, and it decreases the breakdown of acetylcholine. It is found to be one of the most effective substances to help people to stop the breakdown of acetylcholine, and it has been used quite effectively to slow down the progression and the symptomatology in Alzheimer's. Now, this one, say this one three times fast. Let's go. Alpha-glycerol phosphorylcholine. It's a form of choline, and choline is a right part of acetylcholine, and it's well-absorbed, and this form of it crosses the blood-brain barrier well and very effectively increases acetylcholine. And again, it's been studied in Alzheimer's and other memory kinds of problems and dementias to have very good results. Acetyl-L-carnitine is similar structure and binds the receptors. So instead of it increasing the level of acetylcholine, it actually binds to the receptors. And then pantothenic acid, we use that a lot with people with adrenal fatigue, right? As much as 500 milligrams three times a day. And one of the ways it has a really good effect is by increasing the amount of CoA and increasing acetylcholine. Okay, coenzyme A is an important Krebs cycle metabolism, and it's important in energy for energy production. So pantothenic acid helps to increase that coenzyme CoA, which then increases the acetylcholine. So these are some of the things that you can use in balancing acetylcholine. In addition, from foods, there are things that contain lecithin, and we'll look at some of the food. Let's look at the antagonists, and then we'll look at the foods. So gluten, we already said that, poor blood sugar imbalance, poor oxygenation. But another one that's unique to the acetylcholine versus the other of the neurotransmitters is low-fat diets. When people go on extremely low-fat diets, they're not getting enough of the fatty foods that contain the phospholipids and the precursors to making acetylcholine. So it's really important that you don't advise people to go on extreme low-fat diets. They do need some fats. Now, the places that the most of the acetylcholine is found are in some of the animal foods and in the fatty parts of the animal foods, but there are non-animal foods that contain it that are good sources. And so liver and organ meats, egg yolk, and beef on the animal side, but soy is a good rich source of acetylcholine because it provides phosphatidylcholine in the form of lecithin. Now, all of these foods that contain phosphatidylcholine also contain some of the other phosphatidyls. So the phosphatidylserine is one that is super important for mitigating the effects of high cortisol. So it helps to bring down the cortisol levels and help to protect the cells against damage done by high cortisol levels. So it's one of the phospholipids, and it's sister and cousin or whatever you want to call it to the phosphatidylcholine. Sunflower seeds are also a good source of lecithin, and you can actually buy sunflower lecithin either in a powdered form, a capsule form, or you can get it in the form of like a gel, kind of a gooey, syrupy kind of substance. You can also take supplements of phosphatidylcholine, but it's a lot more expensive and you have to take a fair amount. You can get quite a bit of it from the food. Okay, I think it was 2 tablespoons of sunflower lecithin was the equivalent of a handful of phosphatidylcholine pills. Nuts also contain some acetylcholine or precursors to acetylcholine, but they're a good source of making acetylcholine, as is fatty dairy, which I don't recommend at all because it's not good in general. These are the lifestyle choices. Again, we already talked about the recreational drugs. So those are things to be looking at. Remember, we're not looking at isolated body parts for people. We're looking at the whole. So even if you want to be out there as a specialist, as somebody that specializes in depression or anxiety or memory issues, and that's what you want to attract to you, again, you can't just focus on the brain. You've got to focus on the whole organism because the intimate connection with hormone balance, digestion, nutrients. Okay? I'll just give you a quick rundown. Exercise is super important for oxygenation. Oxygenation to the brain, getting sugar up to the brain, burning excessive sugar. Okay, increase the heart rate. There's so many effects of exercise, and it also has effects on those NMDA receptors. There have been plenty of studies that have compared putting somebody on a regular exercise program to putting them on SSRIs. And guess what? Those that maintained the exercise at a decent level and were consistent had better results than the people on the SSRIs. Shouldn't come as a surprise. So sleep, the importance of sleep. Sleep is super important for cleanup and repair. And if we don't do that cleanup, we've got a lot of debris that circulates in our bloodstream that dampens and affects the neurotransmission. It slows down the neurotransmission. Okay? Sleep is super, super important. We also find that people who get less sleep have higher incidences of memory lapses, so they're not as effective at work. If they took people who deprived them of sleep and had them take a test when they were not deprived of sleep, and the short-term and the long-term memory was definitely a lot better with the sleep. Stress, we've talked about this a bunch, right? The hormones, the epinephrine, norepinephrine, they are actually going to be depleted if a person is under a lot of stress, or it's going to deplete the precursors. Remember, you've got the precursors going more down, all the way downstream to the norepinephrine, epinephrine. It's kind of almost like the cortisol steal, where the pregnenolone gets stolen down to make cortisol. Well, the phenylalanine and the tyrosine and those nutrients get down the pathway to make norepinephrine and epinephrine when you're under a lot of stress. Plus, we have the effects of cortisol on the hippocampus. We have the effects of cortisol on the brain. So there's a lot of things, and this is just super important. And when we get down to what we do about a lot of these things, the basics, you've always got to come back to the basics, and then you can add your fancy little supplements and neurotransmitter precursors and all that. But really, really important to do the basics. Brain exercises. There's a number of different systems of brain exercises. Brain entrainment exercises, there's the cross crawl, a whole body of exercises that was created for kids with sensory integration disorders and ADD. Brain gym, and there's books on it, I have them, sensory integration. Basically, the more you exercise the brain, especially on the acetylcholine side, when you can exercise memory and when you can do like things that make you, force you to do memory, like little puzzles and tricks and those little Sudoku things, those are exercising your brain, and that's going to help you to create better memory and less anxiety and depression. And there's a number of those. There's a guy I interviewed on my radio show. He's a chiropractor, and he put together these little brain entrainment kind of audios that you listen to. He's shown that help to actually stimulate the neurotransmissions, better attention, better focus.
These are things that are really important to get your clients doing. You know, it's one thing to tell them what to eat and what supplements to take and that they should exercise, but the exercising their brain is really critical. You guys do it a lot, right? You come and you listen to my talks and you attend other talks and you're constantly learning and we're exercising our brains. But there's ways to exercise them. Like I like to do those, not the Sudoku, but there's another one called Kokoro puzzles, where you have to add things down and they all have to line up. And they're really challenging, and it's a great distraction from the kind of work stuff that I'm usually doing, and it's really good exercise for the brain. So encourage them. Maybe, you know, pick up a couple of books that have exercises that you can share with them, that you can photocopy or show them how to do, because it's such an important piece. And it's going to affect their memory, it's going to affect their mood, it's going to affect their ability to concentrate and focus.
Emotional recharge, right? We talk about this a lot. Meditation, the effect of meditation, the effect of heart math, the effect on neural plasticity, on memory, on overall calmness. And it's really, really important. And it really just goes back to we need to be focusing on empowering our people to take charge of their health on all these areas. This is holistic health. This is not single focus health. So even if you're focusing on working with people with particular problems, it's fine. But the approach you take needs to be multifactorial. There is no one herb that's great for the brain and that people should just take for it. There's no one herb that or nutrient that people can take. It's a combination and it's a multifactorial. So protect your neurotransmitters through diet and lifestyle choices. You're really reiterating with your people that you're working with. You want to customize the nutrition. How much protein does this person need? How much fat does this need? There's no one set, so experiment with them. Try getting them on more protein and more amino acids. Try getting them on the right fats. If they're on a very, very low-fat diet, help them to get good fats in their diet that are going to help them with their EFAs, and also help them with their precursors for their acetylcholine. So the appropriate balance of whole fresh foods is really the appropriate balance being critical for them, the amount of protein that they need, the amount of fat, the blood sugar balance. And oil change is critical. You really need to get people changing their oils out because most people are using the processed vegetable oils and highly saturated animal fats. And we really need to get them to have more of a balance with their omegas, an omega-6, omega-3 balance, and the right kind of omega-3s, especially DHA and EPA are so important. DHA is really critical for brain function, but EPA is equally important because it's important for inflammatory processes. And brain inflammation is super, super important. Managing inflammation, and that's via avoiding things that cause inflammation, like the processed fats and the high glycemic foods, but also managing it through herbs and foods that decreasing it, and, of course, the balance of EFAs. Avoiding unnecessary medications. There's lots of medications that we didn't even go into that affect the way the neurotransmitters work, affect the way the pre- and the postsynaptic junctions work. Autoimmunity, it goes to say, if they have autoimmunity going on, even if it's not autoimmunity that's attacking the brain, the nervous system, it needs to be addressed because it's inflammatory and it's affecting their function overall. There are a number of autoimmune things that can affect the brain. There are antibodies that can get produced to the Purkinje cells, to the cerebellum, the way gluten affects the brain. Super important that they address autoimmunity and you get them off gluten. Amino acids, of course, precursors to all the neurotransmitters. If they don't have adequate amino acids, how can they possibly make appropriate neurotransmitters? How can they keep their brain healthy and plastic? Rest and sleep, we hit that one. Environmental toxins, reduce them, keep them moving, keep them breathing, and manage their stress and have them have fun. I wanted to share with you some books. There's the Braverman book, the Gabriel Cousins, Why Isn't My Brain Working by Datis Karazian, Healing the Body, Mapping the Mind by Dan Kalish. Haven't actually read that one. I've just glanced through it. It looks good. All of the Mark Hyman stuff related to the mind, very cursory, not as detailed as this, but very much so on the level of the food, the nutrients, mental and elemental nutrients, brain recovery. These are all good books. Brain recovery goes into a lot of the neuroinflammatory stuff. So if you have a passion for learning more about the brain, these are some of the books that you can go through. Daniel Amen, all of his stuff is pretty amazing. There's a lot of books out there, and what I like to do is read and pick up a few things here, a few things there, and understand the basic chemistry. Understand the underlying chemistry so that when you read about something that this is supposed to be good for the brain and that you can have a critical eye for the science and make sure that it's working. I can't say enough about getting people off of gluten, even if they claim they don't have a problem with it, because it can affect their brain and you find out 20 years later that your brain's been eaten away forever. I remember when I interviewed Dr. O'Brien and he said he had the antibody test done and he was like shocked that he came back with 3 different brain antibodies. He says, my brain works just fine. Look at all that I do. And they said, sorry, that's what it is. And he went and he went 100% gluten-free because he wasn't 100% gluten-free. He was probably 98% gluten-free. And sure enough, he got the brain, and he healed his leaky gut and the brain antibodies went away. We have a lot of power in this area. We have a lot of ability to influence our clients and go have at it and do some more research if you feel like it. Use what we've gotten here today. Please get people to go gluten-free. People that don't need to go gluten-free, you're never going to see in your practice. The people who just come in and say, I sleep great, I eat great food, I just want you to tell me what I can do to be better, it's not going to happen. But anybody that has any kind of health issues, the gluten can affect it in all these ways that are so sneaky and are so underhanded. So if you're still sneaking around and having a little bit of gluten here and there, remember your brain. Remember how important it is to have that clear brain. Your practice, your career depends on you being able to access those parts of your brain that have the information that help the people that are in front of you. So go out, have at it, and we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.